Part 2. Foam of the Sea. Peru and Bolivia. Chapter 4. Flight of the Condor. I'm in southern Peru, flying over the Nazca lines. Below me, after the whale and the monkey, the hummingbird comes into view, flutters and unfolds her wings, stretches forward her delicate beak towards some imaginary flower. Then we turn hard right, pursued by our own tiny shadow, as we cross the bleak scar of the Pan-American Highway and follow a trajectory that brings us over the fabulous snake-necked Alcatraz, a heron 900 feet long, conceived in the mind of a master geometer. We circle around, cross the highway for a second time, pass an astonishing arrangement of fish and triangles laid out beside a pelican, turn left and find ourselves floating over the sublime image of a giant condor with feathers extended in stylized flight. Just as I try to catch my breath, another condor, almost close enough to touch, materializes out of nowhere, a real condor this time, haughty as a fallen angel, riding a thermal back to heaven. My pilot gasps and tries to follow him. For a moment I catch a glimpse of a bright, dispassionate eye that seems to weigh us up and find us wanting. Then, like a vision from some ancient myth, the creature banks and glides contemptuously backwards into the sun, leaving our single-engine Cessna floundering in the lower air. Below us now, there's a pair of parallel lines, almost 2 miles long, arrow straight, all the way to vanishing point. And there, off to the right, a series of abstract shapes on a scale so vast, and yet so precisely executed, that it seems inconceivable they could have been the work of men. The people around here say that they were not the work of men, but of demigods, the Viracochas, who also left their fingerprints elsewhere in the Andean region many thousands of years ago. The Riddle of the Lines. The Nazca Plateau in southern Peru is a desolate place, sere and unwelcoming, barren and profitless. Human populations have never concentrated here, nor will they do so in the future. The surface of the moon seems hardly less hospitable. If you happen to be an artist with grand designs, however, these high and daunting plains look like a very promising canvas, with 200 square miles of uninterrupted tableland and the certainty that your masterwork won't be carried away on the desert breeze or covered by drifting sand. It's true that high winds do blow here, but by a happy accident of physics, they are robbed of their sting at ground level. The pebbles that litter the pampa absorb and retain the sun's heat, throwing up a protective force field of warm air. In addition, the soil contains enough gypsum to glue small stones to the subsurface, an adhesive regularly renewed by the moistening effect of early morning dews. Once things are drawn here, therefore, they tend to stay drawn. There's hardly any rain. Indeed, with less than half an hour of miserly drizzle every decade, Nazca is among the driest places on Earth. If you're an artist, therefore, if you have something grand and important to express, and if you want it to be visible forever, these strange and lonely flatlands could look like the answer to your prayers. Experts have pronounced upon the antiquity of Nazca, basing their opinions on fragments of pottery found embedded in the lines and on radiocarbon results from various organic remains unearthed here. The dates conjectured range between 350 BC and AD 600. Realistically, they tell us nothing about the age of the lines themselves, which are inherently as undateable as the stones cleared to make them. All we can say for sure is that the most recent are at least 1,400 years old, but it is theoretically possible that they could be far more ancient than that, for the simple reason that the artifacts from which such dates are derived could have been brought to Nazca by later peoples. The majority of the designs are spread out across a clearly defined area of southern Peru, bounded by the Rio Ingenio to the north and the Rio Nazca to the south, a roughly square canvas of dun-colored desert with 46 kilometers of the Pan-American Highway running obliquely through it from top center to bottom right. Here, scattered apparently at random, are literally hundreds of different figures. Some depict animals and birds, a total of 18 different birds, but far more take the form of geometrical devices, in the form of trapezoids, rectangles, triangles and straight lines. Viewed from above, these latter resemble, to the modern eye, a jumble of runways, as though some megalomaniac civil engineer had been licensed to act out his most flamboyant fantasies of airfield design. It therefore comes as no surprise, since humans are not supposed to have been able to fly until the beginning of the 20th century, that the Nazca lines have been identified by a number of observers as landing strips for alien spaceships. This is a seductive notion, but Nazca is perhaps not the best place to seek evidence for it. For example, it is difficult to understand why extraterrestrials advanced enough to have crossed hundreds of light years of interstellar space should have needed landing strips at all. Surely such beings would have mastered the technology of setting their flying saucers down vertically. Besides, there's really no question of the Nazca lines ever having been used as runways by flying saucers or anything else, although some of them look like that from above. Viewed at ground level, they are little more than grazes on the surface made by scraping away thousands of tons of black volcanic pebbles to expose the desert's paler base of yellow sand and clay. None of the cleared areas is more than a few inches deep, and all are much too soft to have permitted the landing of wheeled flying vehicles. The German mathematician Maria Reiche, who devoted half a century to the study of the lines, was only being logical when she dismissed the extraterrestrial theory with a single, pithy sentence a few years ago. "I'm afraid the spaceman would have gotten stuck." If not runways for the chariots of alien gods, therefore, what else might the Nazca lines be? The truth is that no one knows their purpose, just as no one really knows their age. They are a genuine mystery of the past, and the closer you look at them, the more baffling they become. It's clear, for example, that the animals and birds antedate the geometry of the runways, because many of the trapezoids, rectangles, and straight lines bisect, and thus partially obliterate, the more complex figures. The obvious deduction is that the final artwork of the desert as we view it today must have been produced in two phases. Moreover, though it seems contrary to the normal laws of technical progress, we must concede that the earlier of the two phases was the more advanced. The execution of the zoomorphic figures called for far higher levels of skill and technology than the etching of the straight lines. But how widely separated in time were the earlier and later artists? Scholars do not address themselves to this question. Instead, they lump both cultures together as the Nazcans and depict them as primitive tribesmen who unaccountably developed sophisticated techniques of artistic self-expression and then vanished from the Peruvian scene many hundreds of years before the appearance of their better-known successors, the Incas. How sophisticated were these Nazcan primitives? What kind of knowledge must they have possessed to inscribe their gigantic signatures on the plateau? It seems, for a start, that they were pretty good observational astronomers, at least according to Dr. Phyllis Pitluga, an astronomer with the Adler Planetarium in Chicago. After making an intensive computer-aided study of stellar alignments at Nazca, she has concluded that the famous spider figure was devised as a terrestrial diagram of the giant constellation of Orion, and that the arrow straight lines linked to the figure appear to have been set out to track through the ages the changing declinations of the three stars of Orion's belt. The real significance of Dr. Pitluga's discovery will become apparent in due course. Meanwhile, let us note that the Nazca spider also accurately depicts a member of a known spider genus, Ricinulae. This, as it happens, is one of the rarest spider genera in the world. So rare, indeed, that it has only been found in remote and inaccessible parts of the Amazon rainforest. How did the supposedly primitive Nazcan artists travel so far from their homeland, crossing the formidable barrier of the Andes, to obtain a specimen? More to the point, why should they have wanted to do such a thing? And how were they able to duplicate minute details of Ricinuli's anatomy, normally visible only under a microscope, notably the reproductive organ, positioned on the end of its extended right leg? Such mysteries multiply at Nazca, and none of the designs, except perhaps the condor, really seem quite at home here. The whale and the monkey are, after all, as out of place in this desert environment as the Amazonian spider. A curious figure of a man, his right arm raised as though in greeting, heavy boots on his feet and round eyes staring owlishly forward, cannot be said to belong to any known era or culture. And other drawings depicting the human form are equally peculiar. Their heads enclosed in halos of radiance, they do indeed look like visitors from another planet. Their sheer size is equally noteworthy and bizarre. The hummingbird is 165 feet long, the spider 150 feet long, the condor stretches nearly 400 feet from beak to tail feathers, as does the pelican, and a lizard, whose tail is now divided by the Pan American Highway, is 617 feet in length. Almost every design is executed on the same cyclopean scale and in the same difficult manner by the careful contouring of a single continuous line. Similar attention to detail is to be found in the geometrical devices. Some of these take the form of straight lines more than 5 miles long, marching like Roman roads across the desert, dropping into dried-out riverbeds, surmounting rocky outcrops, and never once deviating from true. This kind of precision is hard, but not impossible, to explain in conventional, common-sense terms. More puzzling by far are the zoomorphic figures. How could they have been so perfectly made, when without aircraft, their creators could not have checked the progress of their work by viewing it in its proper perspective? None of the designs is small enough to be seen from ground level, where they appear merely as a series of shapeless ruts in the desert. They show their true form only when seen from an altitude of several hundred feet. There is no elevation nearby that provides such a vantage point. Line makers, map makers. I'm flying over the lines, trying to make sense of it all. My pilot is Rodolfo Arias, lately of the Peruvian Air Force. After a career in jet fighters, he finds the little Cessna slow and uninspiring, and treats it like a taxi with wings. Once already, we've been back to the airstrip at Nazca to remove a window so that my partner Santha can point her cameras vertically down at the alluring glyphs. Now we're experimenting with the view from different altitudes. At a couple of hundred feet above the plane, Ricinuli, the Amazonian spider, looks like he's going to rear up and snatch us in his jaws. At 500 feet, we can see several of the figures at once. A dog, a tree, a weird pair of hands, the condor, and some of the triangles and trapezoids. When we ascend to 1,500 feet, the zoomorphs, hitherto predominant, are revealed merely as small scattered units surrounded by an astonishing scribble of vast geometric forms. These forms now look less like runways and more like pathways made by giants. Pathways that crisscross the plateau in what seems at first a bewildering variety of shapes, angles, and sizes. As the ground continues to recede, however, and as the widening perspective on the lines permits more of an eagle's eye view, I begin to wonder whether there might not, after all, be some method to the cuneiform slashes and scratches spread out below me. I am reminded of an observation made by Maria Reike, the mathematician who has lived at Nazca and studied the lines since 1946. In her view, the geometric drawings give the impression of a cipher script in which the same words are sometimes written in huge letters, at another time in minute characters. There are line arrangements which appear in a great variety of size categories, together with very similar shapes. All the drawings are composed of a certain number of basic elements. As the Cessna bumps and heaves across the heavens, I also remember it is no accident that the Nazca lines were only properly identified in the 20th century, after the era of flight had begun. In the late 16th century, a magistrate named Luis de Monzon was the first Spanish traveller to bring back eyewitness reports concerning these mysterious marks on the desert, and to collect the strange local traditions that linked them to the Viracochas. However, until commercial airlines began to operate regularly between Lima and Arequipa in the 1930s, no one seems to have grasped that the largest piece of graphic art in the world lay here in southern Peru. It was the development of aviation that made the difference, giving men and women the godlike ability to take to the skies and see beautiful and puzzling things that had hitherto been hidden from them. Rodolfo is steering the Cessna in a gentle circle over the figure of the monkey, a big monkey tied in a riddle of geometric forms. It's not easy to describe the eerie, hypnotic feeling this design gives me. It's very complicated and absorbing to look at, and slightly sinister in an abstract, indefinable way. The monkey's body is defined by a continuous, unbroken line. And without ever being interrupted, this same line winds up stairs, over pyramids, into a series of zigzags, through a spiral labyrinth, the tail, and then back around a number of stair-like hairpin bends. It would be a real tour de force of draftsmanship and artistic skill on a sheet of notepaper. But this is the Nazca Desert, where they do things on a grand scale, and the monkey is at least 400 feet long and 300 feet wide. Were the line makers map makers too? And why were they called the Viracochas?